Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical education, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and, well, you never know what's going to happen when someone calls in, and I'll be giving out those numbers in just a moment. But before we do anything else, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, I certainly was taken by a headline that came out this week, just 2 days ago, actually. Brain function starts to decline as early as age 45. I'm going to give you the details on this study. It's actually a large cohort study called the Whitehall 2 Prospective Cohort Study. Those are code words to scientists, by the way. Prospective means you actually set out to study the thing that you're talking about, which is not always the case. And cohort, of course, means a group, but in the case of science speak, it's a large group that you're tracking over time. You know, famous cohort studies that you will have heard of before would include the Women's Health Initiative, the Framingham study, and there's a doctor's health study that is still ongoing, looking at male physicians, and a nurse's health study looking at females who are tracked over a long period of time and all sorts of variables analyzed. In the case of the Whitehall cognitive study, and I've read the methods section here, and I will totally vet it as having decent methodology. They started out in 1985 with about 10,000 British civil servants. They were in the age range of 35 to 55 at the time, and they were invited to participate in a study. And besides having lots of physical things measured and cholesterol and various other bits, they also had cognitive testing done. Idea is, let's retest these folks every 5 years and see what we find. And this recently published study, which came out in the British Medical Journal just this week, volume number 343, and you can find that online, showed that there was, in fact, a cognitive decline in memory and processing, but not in vocabulary, in men who were 35 at the baseline and then are now 45. So men and women, I should say, because it's about two-thirds men. And in general, they were able to score about an average 3.4% decline in that cohort in terms of their test scores. This is important for several reasons, the primary one being that we have not hitherto thought that cognitive decline begins this early. And it changes our framework, I think, on diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia in general, because it means that things that you do in your 40s and 50s might potentially get a process started that in the long run will lead to dementia. In a related story, I have a candidate for what those things might be. This just came through in the Ivanhoe Medical Breakthroughs website. This was an Alzheimer's disease risk factor. We've all been aware that if you have diabetes or you are overweight or you don't exercise, these are all things that seem to be associated with Alzheimer's disease, along with a lot of other things. But this one in particular seems to link all of this together. And it raises issues because, as we know, as a culture, we've become more and more sedentary and we're getting fatter. Well, in the case of getting fatter, body fat, particularly when it's around the abdomen, is a very metabolically active tissue. It produces over 17 different hormones, including inflammatory hormones and adiponectin. Now, adiponectin is one that we thought was a good guy. It has anti-inflammatory properties, and it actually sensitizes people to insulin. So in terms of my framing of it, I've always thought of it as a positive counter-regulatory hormone that was produced by body fat. But it turns out, in this latest study, they looked at a lot of things. They looked at glucose levels, insulin, glycosylated albumin, which would be similar to the hemoglobin A1C test that we use to track diabetics. They looked at C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory marker. They looked at lipoprotein-associated phospholipase A2, which I have no idea what that is, and adiponectin in 840 patients. About 500 of those were women. They were average age 76, and they followed these prospectively. This was a prospective cohort study, your word for the day. They followed them for the next 13 years. And over this time, remember they were 76 when they started, 159 of the 800 developed dementia. And there were 125 cases of documented Alzheimer's disease. They looked at age, ApoE genotype, because we know that's a genetic marker for Alzheimer's. They looked at weight change. They looked at levels of DHA, which is the protective omega-3 fatty acid. I mean, they controlled for everything they could think of in the study. And the only factor that was predictive of whether you would develop Alzheimer's disease was the adiponectin. And this only in women. But remember, that was 500 of the group. So there just may not have been enough statistical power in the male half to show this. Adiponectin is not a good actor in the brain. It seems that the higher it is, the more likely people are to develop Alzheimer's disease. Now, what do we do with this? We don't let ourselves get fat. We fight the middle-age spread. We exercise. We eat a better diet. And we find a way to beat all of the cultural and the physiological and psychological things that are pushing us in the direction of that middle-aged spread. And there seems good evidence here that that could be a factor that affects decline as early as the age of 45, because one of the things that happens really predictably if you're a British civil servant between the ages of 35 and 45 is that you put on weight. So this may be what links these two things together. I think it's a fascinating thing, and I hope that they'll go back in a follow-up study that's not published in this, but it would be an obvious thing to do in the light of what we now know, and see whether or not if you subfractionate those people in that 35 to 45 age cohort who declined 3.4%, look at the ones who declined and look at weight gain and see if that's a variable that tracks with the decline. I'm willing to bet that if they look for it, they'll find it. Let's go to our first email. This is from an anonymous writer in SoCal. Hi, thank you for your show. I assume that you don't answer emails apart from what you answer on your great show. And more or less, that's true. Here are my symptoms. I would love thoughts, guidance, and perhaps even a next step. At night, I have intermittent pains in different parts of my body that last for 1 to 5, maybe 10 minutes each, and then completely go away. Often with a night sweat immediately after, but not always. Pains are in hips, on one of the other legs, different parts, lower back, neck. In addition to this, I also have peripheral numbing in one or both pinky fingers, sometimes both at the same time, sometimes going up my arms or legs. These also last 1 to 5 minutes and happen maybe 4 to 8 times a night. And again, sometimes a sweat will follow, but not always. This has been going on for 2 to 3 years now. I've seen chiropractors and an osteopath, but have had no success. I'm 54, female, and postmenopausal. So for this anonymous caller, I'm going to start with the numbness in the pinky fingers. This is something I get quite a bit in my regular medical office. And this is almost always due to ulnar nerve compression at the elbow. As we go through menopause, women's body tissues change, and we seem to become more vulnerable to tendon and ligament issues. In Chinese medicine, this is related to absence of moisture because of changes in the qi in the kidney, and this leads to dryness of the tendons. You know, this is a lovely metaphorical way of thinking about it, and they've got herbs and treatments that do seem to target this. So I'm not putting down beautiful metaphors, believe me. However, what I recommend for this writer is padding the elbows at night. If you simply take an old sweater and cut the sleeve off and fold that 3 or 4 times, you'll end up with a torus or a donut-shaped piece of soft wool material. And you wear that around your elbow at night. It keeps you from flexing your elbows too tight, and it also pads the ulnar nerve as it passes through a bone and ligament-topped channel. There's a carpal tunnel and there's a couple of tunnels. This is called the cubital tunnel. after the Latin word for elbow. Anyway, if you can pad that nerve, I think that your tingling in the pinkies will go away. So give me a follow-up call or a follow-up email to let me know if that worked. As far as the migratory aches and pains, that too sounds like a perimenopausal symptom. If you don't want to do hormones to fix it, and I completely understand that, one thing I would suggest is to make sure that your vitamin D levels in your bloodstream are above 35. Borderline or low vitamin D levels cause a lot of weird, unexplained aches and pains, I have found. Another thing to check is your hsCRP and make sure that you don't have an elevated inflammatory marker. If you do, using high-dose fish oil, say 3, 4, 5,000 milligrams a day might do the trick on those aches and pains. Let's go to Sandy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sandy, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. This is Sandy Bradshaw.
Hi, Sandy. What can I do for you?
I just wanted to let people know about this idiopathic infection that I got because I queried friends. None of them knew you could even get it. So I just started with, I had swollen ankles from lack of some allergy, and then it came into an infection. It was burning around the ankle. They need to get into the doctor right away.
Okay. I'll go ahead and talk a little bit about this. Thank you, Sandy.
Yes. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Well, as you gathered, that was one of my medical practice patients, and she's outed herself, giving her full name and everything. So I believe that constitutes permission to talk about her case. But in general, we're talking about something called stasis. And stasis is where the blood vessels, or rather the lymph vessels in the legs simply can't handle the load of fluid. Lots of different causes. Varicose veins is a common one because, of course, the veins are supposed to carry the bulk of fluid that goes into the legs from the arteries. The veins are supposed to carry the bulk of that fluid back out. If the veins are damaged, the valve structure doesn't work and the blood tends to pool in the legs. This leads to literally leakage across the veins into the soft tissues, and the lymph tissues, the lymphatic channels, are supposed to clean up the mess, and they become overloaded, and you develop this condition called stasis, which is fluid or edema in the extremities. Elevation is helpful, and that's, of course, hard to pull off. And sometimes, often, we'll have people use compression stockings, which are just sort of ace bandages turned into stockings that people wear that puts some counter pressure on the tissue and helps get things to flush back into the general circulation. Because the lymph channels are also responsible for immunity, people who have trapped and stagnant fluid, just like, well, stagnant pond water tends to get infected. If you've ever left a glass of water sitting on the counter for, say, a week or so on the back of your desk and then taken a sip of it by accident, you know that water will go bad just sitting there if it isn't moving. And indeed, the fluid in the tissues can become contaminated by bacteria. We do have transient bits of bacteria flowing into our bloodstreams momentarily all the time, and generally taken care of by the immune system. But where the immune system is compromised, as in a situation of stasis, spontaneous infections can occur. And this can be just an inflammatory issue. We call that stasis dermatitis, or it can be cellulitis and bacterial, which is the case in the situation of the collar. This can actually become severe enough to require hospitalization, as I recently had another patient undergo that very problem. So if you have swollen ankles and legs and you've seen a doctor and been told it's not heart failure, then frequent elevation and the use of compression hose is extremely important. Exercise in moderation can also be helpful in clearing stasis, but it's important after exercise to elevate the ankles higher than the level of the heart for a few minutes to help get extra blood flow that you called when you use those muscles to let that drain out so that you have a net benefit rather than a net loss when it comes to advantaging yourself on the stasis. And I want to answer this email from Amber in San Diego. My fiancé and I often get what we call crazy colon, which is both farts and belches, sometimes followed by diarrhea. By the process of elimination, we figured out that lots of dairy isn't very good and coffee isn't good for us either. On a side note, we each had these symptoms before we moved in together, but they've gotten worse since living together. We both eat fermented foods. He likes sauerkraut and I drink a kombucha daily. And we also take probiotics. While looking at other diets to figure out how to get rid of the crazy colon, we stumbled on the paleo diet. Basically, you eat lean meat, seeds, nuts, fruits, and veggies. No dairy, grains, or sugars. What do you think of this diet, Dr. Don? Is it healthy? Are there things I need to watch out for on this diet? Is there something else that you would recommend? I've been listening to your podcast for years and appreciate all that you do. Thanks so much. Well, I'm going to take the last question, is there anything else I would recommend first, and then talk a bit about the paleo diet afterwards. Because what Amber and her fiance have is signs of malabsorption. So it seems to me that they are not breaking down their food, particularly when they eat too much dairy, and that makes sense because many adults have problems digesting lactose or milk sugar. They simply don't make enough of the enzyme. In the case of these two people, they may not be making enough digestive enzymes or enough digestive acid to break down food. That'll lead to a lot of gas because undigested macromolecules get down there to the bacteria in the large intestine, or if they're not lucky, in the small intestine. And those bacteria create gas as a byproduct. They are fermenters. And so you get bubbles when they break down sugar, when they break down starch, and sometimes even when they break down protein. Although it's generally carbohydrate or starch malabsorption that leads to the farts and belches. As far as the diarrhea is concerned, that can be any kind of malabsorption. And when I see those two symptoms in conjunction, I always think trial of high-dose digestive enzymes and maybe some hydrochloric acid pills as well. So that's the specific advice for Amber and her fiance. As far as the paleo diet is concerned, that term was coined by a Dr. Cordain. You can find it by Googling it. He has a book and several other things. And he was, I believe, an anthropologist. And the concept is that eat like a caveman, eat like people ate for most of the, well, we'll say that Homo sapiens has been around for 50,000 years, Neanderthals for around 200,000 or so, they say. But human and anthropoid creatures, we've been around eating pretty much that diet, stuff we could kill and stuff we could gather, but not stuff that we grew. Agriculture is a comparatively recent phenomenon, you know, variably 8,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, but something like that. Not a long time that humans have been doing agriculture. That means animals that give you milk and animals that give you eggs and plants that give you grain. And these are all wonderful things in terms of allowing society to function more efficiently. Agriculture allows for specialization. Otherwise, everybody's running around gathering and hunting. Once you start growing things, well, then you have farmers and then you have kings. And then, of course, you've got grain storage, which means you've got war and armies and generals and the military-industrial complex. In fact, most of civilization is based on agriculture. But maybe our physiologies haven't quite caught up with our civilization. And in fact, I'd say that the current epidemic of diabetes and the phenotypic shift that we're seeing in our young people is pretty good evidence of civilization gone amok, run amok, and causing, you know, extreme harm to its component individuals. So I think the paleo diet is a great concept and a good way to eat. If you eat this diet, you will automatically have less simple carbohydrates, less sugar, and less starch in your diet, and you'll probably lose weight. There's nothing nutritionally necessary that we can't get from lean meats, seeds, nuts, fruits, and vegetables. We don't need dairy, grains, or sugars. They're just highly efficient forms of providing calories. But, you know, efficiency we probably don't need anymore when it comes to calories, since we're looking at pretty much a calorie excess in this country for every man, woman, and child in the country. Although, unfortunately, that is not true for every man, woman, and child on the planet. There are still people dying of starvation, an injustice that, well, I can't even begin to get on my soapbox on that one because I won't get off and it will change the tone of the program. We're going to our next caller, and that's Maria Elena. Hello, Maria Elena. Welcome to the program.
Hello there. I have a couple of, or three actually, terms on a blood test, and I need a definition of them. The first one is ferritin.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, do you want to...
No, to give them all to me. Yeah.
Okay. And then VLDL-3.
Okay.
And then the last one is real, or R-E-A-L, LDL size.
LDL size?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And does it have a pattern A or pattern B associated with that?
Yeah, it has A/B, and then it says abnormal.
Right. Okay. Anything else, or has that done it?
That's it.
Okay, so you had a complete blood panel, probably in reference to a physical. So you have one marker, ferritin, which is generally a marker of iron storage, but it's also what we call an acute phase reactant. So the higher your ferritin, the more iron there is in your system. So if your ferritin is low, that generally indicates a relative iron deficiency. Other measures of iron are serum iron and transferrin saturation, and we generally look at several markers. Ferritin's used isn't quite as reliable because it can be elevated when a person has inflammation or infection. So it can sometimes be off for another reason. Was yours high or low?
It was low.
All right, so that's pretty unequivocally iron deficiency. How old are you?
68.
All right, so we don't recommend generally taking iron in people who are over 50, and particularly women who are postmenopausal, because iron can be inflammatory. But if you have low iron, then we do recommend taking it, at least until you get your iron levels back up to where they should be. I would recommend having your doctor check a serum iron, and if both your serum iron and your ferritin are low, getting at least a stool check to make sure you're not losing blood internally, because you're not menstruating anymore. And colon cancer is a very common cause of low levels of iron deficiency. So a person won't be quite anemic, but they'll have low iron stores, and that's because they're leaking iron. And so it can be a very subtle sign for colon cancer, and certainly if you haven't had surveillance done and your iron levels are low, that needs to be looked at.
Okay.
All right. Now, the other thing is the VLDL-3, that's very low density lipoprotein. We talk a lot about good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, LDL and HDL. This is a smaller version, very low density, very big fat particle. And essentially, it's on its way to being converted by the liver into LDL. There are lots of different particle sizes, and we've honed in on a couple of sizes as being really important and having predictive value. But essentially, this is another one of the fat bubbles. And when you have a sophisticated particle size analysis done, you'll get measures on all of these. It's not good to have a high VLDL. There is an association between that and cardiovascular disease, but it doesn't have as good a predictive value as HDL and LDL. So it has to be looked at in the context of all of the particles to really be a useful measurement. I rarely get any lipid panel that doesn't have at least one of these other lesser particle size is abnormal, either high or low. It's noise, effectively, as far as I'm concerned at this point. We're still searching for the perfect measurement of cardiovascular risk. And for right now, what I am using, based on data, and nothing's surpassed this yet, is I take a look at, for a woman, I take a look at the total cholesterol, and I divide it by the HDL. And if that number is under 3.5, even if the woman's LDL is elevated, as long as it's pattern A, I'm not so worried about her. Now, you have a pattern AB in your LDL, and that's not as good. That suggests that you might have more probability of having plaque form if your LDL is abnormally high. I target, if a person has a pattern A, and they're female, and their HDL is good, I'll let them get up to about 160 on the LDL before I have a talk with them about their diet and their exercise. And yes, it's great if you have a low ratio, but I'm sorry, I had a woman in the office the other day who had a LDL of 182, pattern AB, and she had a high HDL. Her HDL was great. It was like 80. Sorry, I feel like I want to get that LDL down, even if her HDL is high. That LDL of 182, pattern AB, doesn't make me happy. I want it to be 130 or below. You know, this was a person who prides herself on her healthy diet, but is easily 20 pounds overweight. So it's like, you know, there's a little lack of insight there, which I tried to address. I'm not sure how successfully, but that's the life of a primary care doctor. Anyway, I hope that's helped you with understanding what your numbers mean.
Yeah, can you give me the formula one more time for you get the
take the total cholesterol and divide the HDL.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Before we go to our next caller, I'm going to talk about a really critical issue. It's the battle of the titans. There are several situations where the FDA and the DEA are creating major problems in medicine. One of them for me, actually, it's the DEA versus the Federal Healthcare Administration, because we are being told by the Federal Healthcare Administration that we need to use electronic prescribing. There are going to be penalties. They're actually going to start deducting reimbursement from doctors who don't start using electronic prescribing for, oh, say, 70%. I believe the figure's at the moment 70% of their prescriptions. The problem is that the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Association, won't let us use electronic prescribing for anything that's controlled. And for doctors, let's say psychiatrists or pain specialists, well over 50% of the drugs that they prescribe may in fact be controlled substances that they can't electronically prescribe under the current law. We have a big mismatch here, and eventually that one's going to create a huge crash as they start going after doctors. Once you start deducting income, people get really snippy with you. And, you know, when the law won't let you do what the other law says you're supposed to do, we're going to have problems. I hope they change that before that crash hits. That's coming down in 2014. But this one's about ADD drugs. Now, it turns out that the DEA actually sets manufacturing quotas for stimulants. And so that would include all of the drugs that are used for ADD, ADHD. And in case you haven't been paying attention, there has been a huge upsurge in people taking drugs for medically diagnosed ADD, particularly in adult patients. We're seeing people using these drugs. And yes, there is an abuse potential and an abuse problem, particularly in colleges where there's a major black market and people make extra money selling their Ritalin to their classmates who use it to cram for exams. So DEA doesn't like that very much. That's called drug diversion. They set quotas. Well, once the manufacturers get quotas, they have to decide how they're going to assign that. And would you believe that manufacturers are actually deciding to make high-cost branded drugs instead of cheap generics? Surprise, surprise. As a result, many people are getting caught in a crunch. There is a nationwide shortage, particularly in some states, like, would you believe, New York, of ADD drugs. And people can't get the cheap generics. And if you're on a fixed income and your child's in school and you can't get generic Ritalin, you're spending perhaps $200 a month on the branded drug in order to help your child get their education, or in the case of adults with ADD, keep their job. So again, a shortage generated all with good intentions, I'm sure, on the part of the DEA, but we need to get these big agencies figuring it out. Maybe the FDA could simply insist that manufacturers make the cheap generics or split the quota half and half. Maybe they don't have that kind of power. Maybe we need to give it to them. Anyway, just an interesting, complex issue. The most significant piece of information here is that we need better coordination between our federal agencies, particularly where healthcare is concerned. We're talking now to Jamie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jamie. Are you there?
I have two questions, Doctor. One is about feeling cold, and the other one has to do with plaque, because it was just raised by something you said. So let me ask that one first. We get in the mail invitations, us older people, I'm 65, to take these preventative tests that can tell us how much plaque we have, or allege that they can, and I am frustrated by always looking indirectly at HDL and LDL rather than knowing, in fact, whether I have buildup in my arteries. Mm-hmm. So can't we look at the direct evidence rather than the indirect evidence?
Well, yes, but unfortunately, you got a personal letter from Peggy Fleming, didn't you?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, but I get these things from time to time.
The one that I get started getting as soon as I turned 50 was a personal letter from Peggy Fleming telling me how she had found her carotid artery disease by one of these tests and what a great thing it was. And of course, everyone thinks of Peggy Fleming. They remember her from, you know, the Olympics and ice skating. And so totally healthy, pretty girl. So we all go, oh my God, if she can get it, I can get it. Anyway, to answer your question, it depends on the test. The only way that you can look at plaque in the coronary arteries is invasive. You have to either put dye in the arteries and take a picture of the heart. That's called an angiogram. You could thread an ultrasound device into the coronary arteries and measure it directly, and that's used in research, but it's technically difficult and not done as a diagnostic tool in the population. Anything else is an indirect marker. So if you get a CT scan and get a calcium score to see how much calcium there is in your arteries, that's an indirect marker that correlates with plaque in some people, but the correlation isn't perfect.
Is the angiogram dangerous?
Well, the angiogram is definitely dangerous. I mean, think about it. First of all, they're sticking something in your groin, threading it all the way up into your heart, and then they're going to put dye in there. The dye itself can cause an allergic reaction. Obviously, you know, you're threading something up into the heart, you can trigger an arrhythmia, and furthermore, you could punch a hole in the wrong thing on your way up there. People do die occasionally of complications of angiograms. That's why we don't do them routinely unless we think the person actually has something that we need to fix.
Okay. Now, let me just live with the indirects then.
Yeah. And I mean, you can measure the carotid directly with ultrasound because it's on the neck and you can look at plaque there. And if a person has, let's say, 70% blockage of plaque in one carotid, they have a risk of a stroke. And we start thinking about doing something, either thinning their blood to reduce the chance of clotting or even going in there and reaming out that plaque because, and statistically, when you ream out a plaque or do a stent in the carotid, you cause a few strokes, but you also prevent a few more. And so the question is, how high does the risk of stroke have to be before you give the person a risk of stroke in order to reduce their risk of stroke? You see what I mean? There's kind of a catch-22 there. The other thing that those population tests do is they look at your aorta. If you're a male who over 50 who's ever smoked, you have a substantial risk by 70, certainly, of having an aneurysm of the aorta. If anyone in your family has an aneurysm, you have an increased risk because there's certain hereditary factors that you may have gotten. And looking at the aorta through ultrasound is easy and done readily by these tests. I don't like these screening tests because, first of all, if you have health insurance, you can get your doctor to order these tests and they're generally covered. Secondly, they cheat, basically, is how I see it. They don't give me something I can use medically, so I have to order a second test anyway. If a person comes to me with one of these and let's say it shows that their carotid is blocked, I'm going to need to get a real test where they actually measure it and give me a solid number because all they give me is a thumbs up, thumbs down on these screening tests because they don't want the medical liability of giving a number. So they
oh, I see. Okay.
So it's a little sleazy. I mean, it's not super sleazy. It does provide useful information. If they're abnormal, it gets the person who maybe is a guy who never comes to the doctor, maybe it gets him into my office and that could save his life. So they're not bad per se, but they're also kind of cherry picking and profit skimming and not providing great quality medical information that I can just take on.
I'll just stay in touch with my doctor then.
Yeah.
My other question has to do with perception of cold. I was diagnosed with Raynaud's phenomenon about 2 years ago, and that appeared to affect three of my fingers, which would become demonstrably white. I would put a bit more water. I would feel better, whatever. Now it appears that both of my hands appear newly sensitive to cold, and I'm suddenly aware or thinking that my apartment is not warm enough, which it may not be. I've got a loft, and therefore the heat goes up into the loft. So I'm trying to address the heat issues, but in the meantime, is there any response other than to increase the heart medicines?
Well, yes, there are a couple of things that you should try. One of them is keep your core warm. So fleece vest or a down vest or something like that, you know, sweater vests, but keep your torso really warm. And when you do that, you increase your core temperature, you send a signal to the arms and legs to open up the blood vessels, and it tends to reduce the reflex spasm of the blood vessels that leads to the Raynaud's, and it'll warm up your hands in general because it'll increase your peripheral circulation.
Okay.
So you keep your core warm and your hands will be warmer and you'll be less sensitive to cold water when you wash your hands even. So that's a useful trick. Also, the vitamin niacin is a vasodilator. So using doses of niacin, it can cause flushing if you take too much, but if you find the right amount, a little flushing is good. You want to flush your hands. So using, you know, somewhere in the range of 100 to 500 milligrams a couple times a day, and you'll have to play with the dose to find the right dose, but that could also be helpful for this problem.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Before we go to our next caller, I want to respond to Joan, who wrote about sunscreen. This was in reference to last week's show. This morning on your radio program, you advised a caller that zinc oxide was the best sunscreen, but also white and messy. I've discovered a brand of this that is white when rubbed on, but immediately becomes clearer, a great thing for me because I must wear sunscreen on my face at all times. I do recall that call. I think the thing that made it memorable to me was he felt forced to go on a sailing vacation with a relative, and he was a very pale person who sunburned easily. He was looking for assistance with that. The name of the product that Joan wrote about is called Ocean Potion Face Potion. And I did check it out using the utility on my own website, the Environmental Working Group link. This is a micronized zinc oxide product that does become translucent after it's been put on. The particles are so small, so you look shiny, but does have a solid SPF 45. It has a couple of other active ingredients, including oxybenzone and octinoxate. These are UVA. There is some potential for this being an endocrine disruptor. In other words, it may have some effects on the hormone system. I think under the circumstances of short-term use in a male, not a problem. Long-term use in someone who is pregnant, maybe you could have some reproductive or organ system toxicity, but it's pretty tenuous. And, you know, I kind of say, well, I wouldn't necessarily put stuff like that on an infant or someone carrying an infant internally, but I don't think anyone else is running much of a risk unless you're a real canary and have serious environmental sensitivity issues. And then maybe you've got problems no matter what you do. Let's go to Alan in Paso Robles. Hello, Alan, and welcome to the program.
Yes, PG&E smart meters.
Oh, I didn't get that. Say that again.
The smart meters the electric company wants to put in.
Oh, smart. Yes, the smart meters, the PG&E smart meters. Yes, what did you want to ask about those?
My wife has a chair that's within a couple feet of an outside meter. Mm-hmm. The chair, of course, is inside. Can that present a problem?
How many hours a day does she spend in the chair?
Oh, maybe four.
Okay. Is that like her computer chair? So she's also got a CRT, you know, a computer and Wi-Fi or anything like
that?
No,
she reads and knits.
Okay. I don't think that's going to be a problem for her. It's all about dose, and the farther away you are from one of these smart meters, once an hour it sends a signal that is where the field is generated, and you do generate an electromagnetic field. The field itself is about 10% of the field strength that has been shown to actually have an effect on cells. So it's still not at the dose that we're so worried about biologically, and it's once an hour. It's getting close to a dose that does have known biological effects at 10%. So I recommend that if your bed is like right against the wall and the smart meter's on the other side of the wall, move your bed. A chair that's 2 feet away, it's the inverse square. So if I'm 2 feet away, the amount of impulse I get is a quarter of what I would get at the source. If I'm 3 feet away, then the amount is a ninth. So at that point, you're 10% of 10%. So now you're at 1% of the lowest dose known to have a biological effect. So if you're really worried about it, move the chair 12 inches further over, and that's it.
Okay. I called previously. I had a lattice stone removed, which was oxalate.
Yes.
And I was consuming large amounts of soy products, you know, like Morning Star and Baca and soy milk. And so the doctor said my oxalate content of my urine was tremendously higher than the normal. I went to Wikipedia, and I got to a document that showed the various foods and the oxalate content, and I cannot get there again. They changed it.
Oh, well, you know, all you need to do to get a list of high oxalate foods is put that in the a browser, list of high oxalate foods. The Mayo Clinic website is very good for these sorts of things, and the Harvard School of Public Health website. There is a link, actually, to a really good nutrition site that is run by the Harvard School of Public Health. The Harvard School of Public Health is an excellent source for dietary info, and also has great, sensible analyses of research on nutrition and does critiques. There's an excellent critique. A study came out about a month ago about how taking vitamins causes women to, you know, older women who take vitamins die more frequently than older women who don't. And it was like, yes, but also the study was completely uncontrolled. And there's a good critique of that study. And also what I like with websites is if they give you references so that you can actually, they say, well, they make a declarative statement and then there's a reference. You can click on the reference and you can read the original paper that they're using to back up that authoritative statement. The web is a wonderful tool for that because you can actually check your facts right then and there. But facilitating it the way this site does should be a model for how public education websites work. And so I would encourage anyone who is interested in such topics to look at that link on the Ask Dr. Don website and perhaps bookmark the Harvard School of Public Health website for your own purposes.
Thank you and have a great new year, Dr. Don.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you as well. Bye-bye. Let's go to Anne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anne, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. I'm a 68-year-old woman, freshly 68 last week, and I've been experiencing the slightest, almost ephemeral balance issues for several years. They've increased in regularity in the last year to the point where I finally brought it up with my family practitioner. So she was concerned enough, or at least that she's awesome enough, that she ordered quite a few tests. The test showed me to be normal in all of these areas. She did an ultrasound, we did an ultrasound of my carotid, an echocardiogram, and an MRI. So we've eliminated all the frightening stuff, and I'm now left with no answer, just a little more calmness about the issue. Mm-hmm. It's balance. It's about climbing out of bed and feeling a little off kilter just for a minute, mostly about getting up from bed or turning around quickly during the day, during daily activities. I turn around quickly, I find myself kind of reeling a bit, momentarily.
Yeah, inner ear. So the balance organs in your inner ear seem like they're disrupted, but you're not getting persistent spinning, right?
No.
Okay. And it can be turning over in bed. It doesn't have to be just going from sitting to standing, can it?
No, it's never turning over in bed. It's only when I get up.
Okay, well, I
start across the room.
Yeah, it may be that you've got a delayed postural reflex, so that your blood flow, you have a momentarily delay between the time that you stand up and thus increase the height that your heart has to pump blood from your ankle to your brain changes abruptly, but the blood vessels in your legs don't tighten up quickly enough to compensate. This is actually a fairly common aging change. I know. But
just in case I needed another reminder.
Yes, well, you know, it beats the alternative. But one good trick for this is make a fist, hard fist, and kind of push your hands together and make a hard fist two or three times before you stand up.
Oh.
That sort of triggers the reflex in a lot of people. You can kind of make the reflex kick in.
Before I jump out of bed.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and being a little slower about how you do get up is kind of the general compensation. Sometimes this can be a sign of adrenal insufficiency, so it wouldn't be a bad idea to go on some adaptogenic herbs like licorice, and you could try using licorice and ashwagandha, which is Withanium somniferum. It's an herb that's used frequently. Ginseng, Korean ginseng, is another one that's used frequently for this. So, you know, going in the herbal route for adrenal support for a month or two and seeing if that helps would be the other bit of advice I'd have.
And do that in conjunction with the...
Yeah, do that in conjunction with the hand exercise and see what you get.
And so being a healthy, active 68-year-old has worked my favor, except that I move too fast. Is that what's going on?
Well, you know what? No matter how well you live, you're still going to get older.
Oh, yes. And yes, so, I've noticed that.
Yeah, and so stuff happens.
Yeah, I get quite a bit of confirmation of that each day.
Some of it's reversible, however, or supportable.
Well, thank you. That's good information. So it wouldn't be like inner ear stuff.
Not when it's happening posturally, like you're describing. I would chase this.
I see.
I would chase this first.
Okay. So the condition you described would relate to also if I spin quickly, like in the store, or turn around.
No, that's more likely inner ear. But because you're saying so much that it's, you know, not when you turn over in bed.
No.
So that's why I'm saying go after the postural reflex first.
Got it. Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye. And we're going now to Kim in Santa Cruz. Hello, Kim, and welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm a 48-year-old premenopausal woman, and I had some pain in my left lower quadrant, and so I got an ultrasound, and I have on my right ovary a simple cyst and a septated cyst, but on my left ovary a complicated cyst. And I'm wondering about if they're dangerous and how they're different, and the indication for the doctor says just wait and watch and look in 6 to 8 weeks to find out if the complicated cyst goes away.
Right. Well, let's start by saying that ultrasounds are giving you a blurry picture, kind of like the old technology satellite weather images.
Okay.
And it has the predictive value of a bad satellite weather image. You know, it's got some predictive value, but you still can't say it's going to rain on Tuesday at 3 p.m. Now, that means that you can't say it's not cancer, but you can say that with three cysts, both ovaries involved, these are ovaries that are overstimulated. And so that's good, because if you had one complex cyst and the other ovary looked great, we'd be more worried about that one complex cyst being bad. So having three is good, even though that seems paradoxical. So I want to throw that out first. A complex cyst just means that it's cloudy inside when they look with the ultrasound. Could be that it bled and there's a blood clot in the middle.
Oh.
Okay. A septum is just a wall between two cysts. And if you think about blowing soap bubbles, you know how sometimes you'll get one bubble and sometimes you'll get two bubbles with a flat wall between them.
Uh-huh.
And that's what they're seeing on the ultrasound. And that flat wall is called the septa. And so an overstimulated ovaries, what I'm thinking. So it makes sense, rather than, you know, jamming in there and doing surgery, to wait for them to go away. And in women who are in their 20s and 30s who tend to have overstimulated ovaries and are very unlikely to have ovarian cancer, just a watchful waiting stance is the most proportionate and sane approach to this.
Okay.
If after 3 months you've still got a complex cyst on the left side, then probably you're going to have to investigate further, and you may have to go in and aspirate that cyst. But we don't do that lightly, because when you go in to check out a cyst medically, you have to be ready to deal with an ovarian cancer. And if you puncture that cyst and it is cancer and you spill cancer cells in the abdomen, that's very, very, very bad.
Right.
So,
okay. And I'm 48, so I'm like approaching menopause. So
right.
Does that change the picture?
It makes it a little more likely that it could be cancer, but it isn't that convincing with both sides being involved.
Okay. So I, you know, looked at it on the internet, of course, got worried. So I asked my doctor. What she did is she sent me to have the CA125 test, blood test.
Yeah, I wondered about that. What did that come back at?
I don't know yet.
Okay. Well, if it comes back at 5,000, you have a serious health issue and you'll be going to surgery next week. If it comes back at, you know, a normal level, that's extremely reassuring, although not 100%.
So like below 90?
I don't remember off the top of my head what the reference range is for the test, but if you're within the reference range, you're good.
Okay. And why was my doctor not concerned at all?
Well, she's probably concerned but not wanting to freak you out, and so trying to be reassuring but at the same time follow up appropriately. That's always a tough needle to thread.
Okay.
You know.
So 6 to 8 weeks is safe to wait to see if it resolves on its own.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that I've overstimulated ovaries is okay, given that they're on both sides, and complex just means that it's got blurriness inside, which is a little worse than just a regular functional cyst.
Precisely.
Okay.
So it's going to be a little nail chewing till you get that CA125 back.
Okay.
And then after that, you just kind of do some meditation and strive to think about other things. Don't dwell on it. And don't Google it.
I know. Okay, I already did.
But. Yeah, I know, but don't do it again.
Okay, well.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this hour as much as I have. It's been a good show, and I hope you'll join me next week for more of the same. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.